So, first off, Bill, thank you very much for agreeing to be interviewed. And what is your exercise background?
Well, currently I'm ACE certified, and I previously had a couple of NSCA certifications, which I let lapse. But before those, I started as a trainer back in 1983 at probably one of the original places in New York City. And prior to that, I probably started training just with friends in garages and basements and such, probably around 1970.
So you've got
So,
a lot of experience in this then.
right, yeah, well, and I guess through the magazines, I guess in the set through the 70s, I came across Mike Mentzer's writing, which was what I thought was the best instruction I was around at the time. Now, at this point, I consider myself hit influenced rather than pure hit, just because I've kind of refined what I do in terms of weightlifting. I'm not as concerned with force reps or pre-exhaustion or any of that type of stuff. And I do include physical activities other than weightlifting. But at the time, it was, at the time, all that message stuff was great.
Yeah, I've seen his stuff as well, and it's very on for the high intensity training. So you're
Well,
practicing.
and what stood out about it in the 70s is that Nautilus wasn't quite as prominent. In the 70s, Nautilus and high intensity kind of training was more known in professional football and that arena, not so much through the muscle magazines at the time. And Mensa was the only guy, or one of the few guys at the time, who was not only publicizing it, but also had the competition records to back it up.
Which is very, very important. So you were practicing all of these, and how did you come to the methods that you lay out in congruent exercise, your specific exercises there, and your specific approach to training?
When I was about around 40 years old, I ruptured my own biceps and triceps training, and not only did I do that after years of studying the HIIT material and the NSCA material and everything else that I could get my hands on as far as exercise literature, but when I recovered, there were some exercises in which I lost no strength at all, and others I couldn't even get into position. So that led me to put the exercise material aside, and I went to mechanics, anatomy, and biomechanics texts to try to figure out what was going on. So what I ended up doing was I would start with a basic exercise and compare that to the muscle and joint function that was in the anatomy and biomechanics textbooks, and then I would modify the exercise to match the proper muscle and joint function. So, I mean, at first that was the Moment Arm exercise manual, and then I turned it into presentation to Club Industry Award for the NSCA and HIIT seminars. And then the YouTube series, and then finally was the congruent exercise manual. So each step along the way, I tried to refine it a little bit more.
Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen your YouTube presentation and parts of the movement arm exercise manual online, and it's really interesting to see your approach to just the biomechanics and making every exercise work with the least amount of strain. So, now you deal with some pretty intricate biomechanics in that book, and I just want to address squats since virtually everybody does squats and talks about them. So, are squats congruent? Are they a good exercise? And Why or why not?
Well, I mean, as you know, the whole first chapter of the book is basically on that, more or less. And I would say that both body weight or hip belt squats are congruent in that they both do a pretty good job of matching the resistance changes through your own body leverage to the muscle torque for the glutes and the quads. So in other words, they almost have a built-in, your body has like a built-in cam that matches what the muscles are capable of. But more importantly, what body weight and hip belt squats require of the joints and muscles of the spine matches how the spine is supposed to work. The issue I have is with the barbell squat or with any squat where you load the spine at the neck, for all the reasons I lay out in the book. And the issue isn't really whether the barbell squat is productive, because it obviously is. But the issue is really the small margin of error when it comes to loading the spine that way. So it's not just a muscular issue, because when you're loading the spine, you're also loading the discs and the vertebrae and the attachments between them. So now, having said that, you know, while I no longer personally use barbell squats for myself or for clients, you know, if that's somebody's tool of choice, there are ways you can make it less risky. My personal preference, though, is to just sidestep it altogether.
Okay, and just focus on the hip squatting movement with the weight from the hip rather than trying to balance it on top of the back.
Well, yeah, again, balance, you know, balance seems like an interesting aspect too, because you know the mechanisms for balancing, again, as I point out in the book, you know, your spine is adequate to balance around the spine. But when you put a bar across your back, now you're extending what the spine is trying to balance several feet laterally. So it's fairly unique to it's it, and it's a unique skill just to balancing the bar laterally. So balancing the bar in a barbell squat is probably not going to serve you anywhere else other than barbell squatting.
Yeah, and how it builds that very specific ability. Moving on, you also talk about the full range of motion in your book and how, because when I was first being exposed to exercise, I was always told, well, you should always do everything through the full range of motion to get the most benefit. Is that right in your opinion?
Well, you know, that's become one of those phrases too that in the context of the early or mid-60s made a little more sense compared to what was happening at the time. But the whole concept of full range of motion doesn't really hold up when you look at it through the biomechanics. So, for instance, muscles express their strength as muscle torque, which exists in a pattern. And it's not an unknowable pattern. It's called muscle torque curve. So as somebody's joint angle changes, so does the amount of torque that the muscle can generate, at least relative to other joint angles. You know, all other things being kept the same. So as long as your exercise includes the joint angle for peak muscle torque, it really doesn't matter if you omit the excessive parts of the range of motion. Because again, how the muscle expresses its strength through each joint angle is in you would never ever change the muscle torque of your bicep to be stronger with the elbow straight compared to with the elbow bent.
Yeah, well, that's
That
just
muscle pattern is
impossible.
always going to be in play. And on the downside of that, if you concentrate on the excessive range, the extremes of the range, not only is it going to make your workout more inefficient because you're adding, say, extra exercises or extra, let's say you're adding extra exercises,
mm-hmm.
okay, but when you put the muscle at a full stretch, if it stretches too much, the joints may shift. And keeping a stable posture is one way you stay uninjured during weight training.
Yeah.
So, I'm going to take one final point that's pretty straight out of the textbooks. The idea that you're recruiting different fibers at different parts of the range of motion, this isn't the case, because it's pretty clear that fiber recruitment is based on the load and maybe your effort, but it's not based on joint angle.
Mm-hmm.
So the same fibers in a curl that move your elbow from straight to, say, 90 degrees bent are the same fibers that move your elbow from 90 degrees bent to your hand by your shoulder. They're just acting at a different point in the muscle torque curve. If somebody wants to recruit more fibers, the answer is either lift a heavier weight or exert greater effort.
As far as
fibers within one specific given muscle, the joint angle doesn't change which fibers are actually working.
That totally makes sense. And that is a brilliant way to describe it.
Something that makes sense if you're not... It makes sense if you look at the biomechanics of the anatomy. But for years, I said full range of motion also, because I was only looking at the muscle magazines and the Nautilus material, and I was just kind of reinforces itself. And in the context of, say, 1960s bodybuilding, where there was a lot of partial reps being emphasized, lockouts, telling that person who was not doing anywhere near a full rep, if they did a full range of motion, they may now start including that joint angle for peak muscle torque, and so they would get better results. But that's only because if you told the person doing partial movements to do a more of a range of motion, they would get to that joint angle where the muscle is strongest. If you can work all day at a weak joint angle, and it will fatigue and it will burn, but you're really not going to challenge the force capability of that muscle.
Mm-hmm. You're going from a very inefficient exercise, and by full range of motion, you make it better by including that joint angle, though not...
Right, but then it doesn't follow that, well, okay, so if I expanded the range of motion to include that joint angle, if I expand it even further, I'm going to get even more benefit out of it. Because that's just not how fibers are recruited.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. You also mentioned in your book, you talk a little bit about deep muscles, especially the spine, and how they're used to support the body in static positions.
Now, right.
Yeah, this really interested me personally, because I do a lot of martial arts, and some of them have me holding horse stance or other rather awkward static poses for a long time. So I was curious about, for strengthening the deep spinal and support muscles, are regular barbell exercises better for that, or are simply static stances and holding exercises better?
Well, the question of better is a tricky word.
Ah, yes.
Because barbell exercises will load the deep muscles around the spine and rotator cuffs and deep muscles around the hip. They will load them. The issue is the margin of error.
Mm.
So if you make a mistake with the barbell, lose concentration, or from fatigue, your form breaks down or your posture breaks down, again, your margin of error to an injury or to setting yourself up for a chronic condition isn't that great. But in general, the what I call the deep muscles, like the multifidus in the back and the rotators in the back, and even the rotator cuff in the shoulder, and you know, dozens of other muscles that are close to the joint. When you look at the anatomy diagram of them, they're short, thin, close to the joint, which implies that their role is to hold the joint together. When you look at the classic muscle chart, the bigger, more superficial muscles, the ones that you can see the shape of, pectorals, quads, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the deep muscles hold the joint in place, work statically to hold the joint together, hold the posture of the joint, while the big muscles move the limb or provide the force. So the relationship is that the without the deep muscles, the bigger muscles don't have the stable platform to push against.
Mm.
So, if for instance, you go about horse stance and other martial arts practices where you're holding a you're holding the posture.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, as far as the muscles go, that's probably sufficient for that particular, you know, role.
Mm-hmm.
And even if somebody was barbell squatting, if somebody was a powerlifter, for instance,
mm-hmm.
and they needed to do, you know, they had a weakness in the deep muscles, static contraction might be more appropriate. The real issue in fitness comes about, like, the real issue is that when do you need that specific deep muscle work?
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, I mean, you know, if you see some of the so-called functional exercises or other of the, say, conventional fitness programs where they have you doing many, many different core exercises, many, many different trunk exercises, well, the issue is whether, you know, do you really need to do a specific exercise for every specific muscle you can find in the anatomy book?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would say probably don't. I would say if you have a previous injury, or if you have a specific task like you described, you know, or if you just want to do a measure of preventive work, then you do the minimum. But if somebody is not having any of those problems, and if none of those situations apply, it may not be necessary to do like a whole half-hour trunk class, for instance.
Mm-hmm. It's a waste of time, then, to be really focusing on every individual little muscle group in the body.
Well, right, and the other thing, too, with that approach is, the deeper the muscle, the less actual control you have over it.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, you can decide to lift, to raise your arm, and you pretty much know it's your deltoid, and you can point exactly, here's the deltoid doing the work. But you couldn't do the same for the infraspinatus, for instance.
Yeah.
You can't decide, okay, I'm going to make my teres minor work this way. Again, as I pointed out in the book, the deeper muscles, they may blend together so they're not as distinct from each other, or they're so close in function that you really can't isolate one or the other of them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably not the most productive use of your time to try to identify every single muscle in every single position that it might possibly work at.
Yeah, that's. I mean, you can definitely spend your time just better doing more regular exercises in the gym most of the time. So, you talk a lot in your book about congruent training specifically designed to put less strain on the body and the connective tissue in ways that it is not meant to be stressed from a biomechanical standpoint. Are the congruent exercises, obviously you've tailored them to be appropriate for people with injuries or people who want to go easy on their bodies, are they appropriate and worthwhile for hardcore athletes and people who are really pushing the envelope as well?
Well, you know, if I was one, or if I was training one, I wouldn't want preparing for my sport to add more unnecessary strain on the joints than the sport itself, right? I mean, if you're a football player, you know, getting tackled and slammed to the ground as part of the sport, that's not enough. You're going to add strain to your joints in the weight room also. Or, you know, an NBA basketball or basketball player, right? 60 or 80 games or more. You know, that's not enough stress on their feet, the knees and their hips. You're also going to, you know, do some kind of barbell squat that's also going to put a lot of pressure on them. You know, even young teenage athletes have wear and tear issues nowadays, especially lately when there's emphasis on doing one sport year-round. So I personally don't see why a competitive athlete wouldn't want to make their weight training as joint-friendly as possible, because they're going to have enough wear and tear from their sport. However, having said that, I also know that, you know, the aspiring athlete is willing to do any kind of excessive measure if it possibly gives them an extra benefit. So I do understand that a lot of them just aren't receptive to this approach.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think I mentioned the story in the book where I had someone come into the studio to have their body fat checked, and they were clearly ripped. I mean, really, just shredded.
Mm-hmm.
But they were hunched over and twisted. So I asked what happened, and the guy says, well, I threw my back out doing CrossFit. I was doing tire flips. And I said, well, man, I said, you know, when you get better, train with me, and I'll train you just as hard, and I guarantee we won't hurt your back. And he said, as he was bent over and twisted and grimacing, he said, well, thanks, but I really like the class. Look how well it worked. So in his mind, the trade-off between getting in shape was the risk of, like an almost crippling injury, right?
Yeah.
Now, like, how do you get that? I'm not going to argue with that. I mean, that's the guy's choice. That's his choice. I find the most receptive people to this material are probably guys around my age, which is mid-50s, and they've been doing everything, quote, right all along, and maybe they're experiencing, you know, more aches and pains than they thought they should have. So they start questioning, or they do as I did, they just go back to the material they already read, and it seems to confirm it, but they can't deny that they're having some backache or shoulder aches. And I get comments like Richard Winnett of the Aegis, who had a newsletter called Aegis Athletes.
Mm-hmm.
About 10 years ago, he was a little dubious of the material. And recently, he congratulated me on congruent exercise. And when I pointed out to him, gee, that's not what you're saying 10 years ago, he said, well, you know, I heard a lot more now.
Mm.
So the person who's starting to feel some extra pain, they're very receptive to it. You know, and after that, you know, some younger trainees who aren't caught up in the scene, but they want the benefits of it with as little risk as possible, I mean, they're also receptive. I guess like someone like yourself and Anthony Johnson of the 21 Convention, who put up the presentation video.
Mm-hmm.
Him and his... him and a lot of guys who follow his work are very receptive to the material.
Well, it's good to hear that it's getting out there more. And if somebody wanted to start just doing more congruent exercises, what are two or three basic congruent exercises that you would recommend to them in place of, say, common barbell type exercises or common exercises they're doing in the weight room?
Well, I mean, the first one would be to do some alternative to heavy barbell squats. So whether that's like the nitric leg press, which I prefer, mm-hmm. or hip belt, or biking uphill, or even, you know, just using a lighter weight in the barbell squat with really precise form, you know, some alternative to the heavy barbell squat. Again, assuming the person's not a powerlifter, assuming that they're not. Their goal isn't to squat as heavy as they can.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing would be on a push-up or a chest press to use that specific range of motion where your elbows aren't being driven back behind the plane of your body at the bottom of the rep. And the third would be the congruent chin, which I have which has the YouTube videos up of, and is pretty much the diametric opposite of the bouncing chin-up that you see a lot on online. Those three exercises, some form of leg press, some a push and a pull, you know, they're probably going to get, most of what they're going to get from weight training. And if they keep those ranges to the ones I'm talking about, probably with a minimum of aches and pain training.
That sounds great. I hope some people pick those up and start using them.
One thing about that type of consolidated routine, as it's come to be called,
mm-hmm.
If someone does that and isn't happy with what they end up with, let's say, you know, they don't think their biceps or triceps are big enough from that, then it's worth trying adding in a specific bicep or a specific tricep exercise. Because one thing that's pretty clear from the biomechanics texts are that if there's more than one muscle in a chain doing a task, the body's going to pick the biggest muscle in the chain to do most of the work as an energy-saving measure. So in a chin-up, for instance, the lats are going to do most of the work because they're the biggest muscle on the chain. So, which is not to say that the biceps and the other smaller muscles aren't doing work, but the lats are going to take the brunt of the work because it's going to require less energy for the lat to do the task compared to, say, one of the smaller forearm flexors.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody is interested in, for whatever reason, cosmetic purposes or just because they want to be, you know, they want to attempt to develop their physique like in a balanced fashion,
mm-hmm.
they probably have to do more than those three exercises. You would have to do at least one exercise where that muscle is the biggest muscle in the chain, which still ends up being a lot less than, you know, flipping through the magazines would have you do.
Yeah, with 12 or even 15 exercises or something like that.
Well, you know, even the classic garden or Mensa routine, where, you know, most of the superficial muscles are covered in the course of the week, where that muscle is the biggest muscle in the chain. Where that muscle is the biggest muscle in the chain covers all the bases. And again, we're still talking about a relatively small amount of time.
Mm-hmm. So, transitioning a little bit, what is your take on functional training, CrossFit, and this whole emphasis on doing like exercises that are directly functional, however those people are defining that.
Well, right there is the first problem, right? Mm-hmm. Functional training means whatever the person says it means. So, again, like I put on the book, to me the best parts of the functional training catalog, so let's call it that, the best parts of it distinguish between the muscle that moves the limbs and the muscle that stabilizes the joints and suggests appropriate training for each of them. The worst part of the functional training catalog, ignore that distinction and they risk your long-term joint health for the sake of the hard workout right now. You know, add that the hard work immunizes you against chronic joint issues.
Mm-hmm.
So, So that's kind of my, as far as the, you know, quote, functional training, that's my take on it. It's not all useless. There is a role for some of it, but it's a lot of times it's just used as an excuse for, you know, sloppy form or sloppy manual labor, you know, masquerading as exercise.
Mm-hmm. And just by the CrossFit story you shared earlier, there are definitely those people who get results they like but are injured or just otherwise.
Well, again, you know, the issue isn't the results. I mean, productive isn't necessarily the issue, but mm-hmm. productive at the margin of error is the issue.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, so personally, you know, like CrossFit or P90X or any kind of boot camp inspired workout, they're just not my preference, just not my thing. Mm-hmm. Because I think you get too caught up in being competitive and keeping up the pace that you don't pay attention to posture and how you're loading your joints. Now, if somebody likes that pace of no rest, you know, like I suggest in the back of the book, just line up congruent exercises in the no rest format and just don't take the rest. But, you know, if sloppy form becomes the measure of how hard the person's working and you're getting congratulated on sloppy form, I just don't think it bodes well for the future of that person's joints.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the other thing, again, this is a preference, but, you know, always congratulating yourself for getting through a tough workout. Well, you know, they're not doing it for their team, you know, like a sport you can play and hurt.
Mm-hmm.
When you're not doing it as an actual boot camp, when you're doing it for others in your unit, you know, they're doing it for selfish purposes, right? They're beating their own joints up and congratulating themselves on beating their own joints up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, if I have competitive urges I want to get out of my system, I'll do an actual sport rather than take it out on my own body. You know, do a sport and take it out on somebody else's body.
Exactly. So, exercise is one chunk of, correct exercise is one big chunk of the puzzle, but what's your opinion on the role of correct diet, eating, and supplementation? Because I know in the last 40 or 50 years there's been a whole wide spectrum of different ideas on that.
Well, you know, I've had clients who've done well with, like, every kind of diet, from vegetarian and Weight Watchers to paleo and no carb. So I really don't claim any particular position other than what works best for the client. The paleo camp has their authorities and their studies they refer back to, but so does the vegetarian side.
Mm-hmm.
So for me personally, I don't try to attach like a moral or intellectual judgment on someone's food choice. I'm more interested in helping the person manage weight and maybe manage inflammation with some kind of workable plan that they can stick with. And again, whatever that looks like for the person, again, some people seem to do well without carbs, some people seem to do well without meat. It's that's really not a fight I really feel comfortable wading into.
Okay. And as a last thing, as we were talking about with that functional training aspect, many people are of the opinion that if they want to get in shape, they have to do boot camps or go, you know, work out 5 or 7 days a week or just totally commit themselves. Is this a good mindset? Is it productive short-term and long-term? What do you think?
Well, you know, I understand the visceral gut appeal of a hard workout,
mm-hmm.
but I don't buy that it's necessarily necessary that, you know, you want to die every time you work out. like referring back to the guy who came in the studio for the body fat check, and to me the cost of getting in shape is the time and effort that you're putting into it that you could have put into something else.
Mm-hmm.
The cost of getting in shape isn't that you're risking injury or that you're adding wear and tear to your joints. That's just risking injury and adding wear and tear to your joints. The higher risk doesn't mean the higher benefit. Once you get the benefits, you got them.
Yeah.
So, and as far as whether it's the best way to train, you know, the first question you got to ask is, well, train for what? You know, if someone's training for a specific sport or a specific activity, you got to practice the activity. You know, and maybe you add a cardio component that's related to the pace of that activity. You know, it's like an interval training that's based on the sport. And maybe you add specific exercises for areas that are likely to get injured in that activity. And then general exercises for overall strength. But, you know, then let your body sort it out. You know, if you're practicing technique, your body will sort out the strength. If somebody, you know, if again, answer the question, train for what? If someone just wants to get in shape in a general sense, not necessarily a competitive shape, well, then, you know, then I think the question really is, well, how active are you outside of the gym? You know, someone who does manual labor 5 days a week or someone who dances 6 days a week, you know, one serious, careful workout a week in the gym might work best for them. So on the other hand, you know, so like I get clients in the studio here who are adults with normal life commitments as far as work and school and family, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I generally try to steer them towards two regular workouts a week. And in those workouts, they're doing anywhere between 10 to 30 minutes of some kind of cardio, and maybe 10 to 15 minutes of weights, you know, using my stuff and kind of going in a high intensity direction. It's not pure hit.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe finishing with 5 minutes of stretching into the hamstrings and the lower back. And again, you know, train for what is really the key question.
Yeah. Just as long as you've got your goal in mind when you start training, then you can work towards it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's why, again, so many of these internet arguments and headbutting go on, but no one's actually asked what the real question is.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, the subtitle of congruent exercise is how to make weight training easier on your joints. Well, if that's not somebody's interest, I don't expect them to like it or even to look into it. So, I mean, the subtitle is key. If somebody doesn't want to risk the joints for the sake of getting in shape, or if someone's already experiencing some aches and pains and, you know, is considering dropping it or changing it just to avoid the aches and pains, that's kind of who the material is for.
Mm-hmm.
Again, what are they training for? Pretty much the key question.
The key question there. Well, all right, Bill. Thank you so much for your time, and thank you so much for sharing your knowledge.
Well, thank you, Aaron.
Mm-hmm.